listen to AJ Radio.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over that. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. So I'm not saying we aren't going to let any dog or water hose that's turn us around. We aren't going to let any injunction turn us around.
Good evening, America. This is Just Cause Radio, bringing messages around the world. That's powerful stuff, isn't it, Lamont?
Absolutely.
God, I mean, that is that. When you hear that, it just I just had to write it down. It's like, you know, somewhere I read.
Absolutely.
That's incredible. So, how's everybody doing, Cliff? Lisa?
Oh yeah, doing great.
Doing good, Sam.
You're tuned to a Just Cause Radio, where we bring the message of justice around the world. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Lamont Banks, Cliff Stewart, and Lisa Stewart. We'd like to invite our listeners to join in on this evening's conversation as we dive into and explore some of the situations regarding injustice that's going on in our nation. Our phone number this evening is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. This evening, we're going to spend some time talking about how wrongful convictions impact families. And we have a lot of information that first-hand information. We've also, our research team has done some research to pull information about that subject. And, you know, a lot of times people look at a situation of a person who's been wrongfully convicted, and they only think about the fact that the person who has been wrongfully convicted is impacted, but it extends far beyond that person who is beyond the walls. And it's bad enough that a person has to be subjected to the things that they are subjected to while they are incarcerated, but when it extends to their families, their children, their friends, their associates, and so forth, you know, that's one of the things we want to talk about a little bit. Before we get too far, Lisa, let's do a disclaimer.
Yes, we want to remind everyone that we are not attorneys and that A Just Cause does not provide legal advice. You want to contact your own personal legal advisor for your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests do not necessarily, my God, can I talk tonight? reflect that of A Just Cause. And as always, we want to thank you for tuning in and choosing to spend a little time with us this evening.
And when we get a little further into our main topic of the evening as far as wrongful convictions and how it impacts families, I want to point out that you definitely want to stay tuned as we, you know, get into that subject, because our special guest that's going to be joining us a little bit later is Mr. Bill Ferguson, and he is the father of the wrongfully convicted Ryan Ferguson. And if you're familiar with that case happened in Kansas, and where a young man was accused of murdering, I believe it was a news reporter, and spent several years in prison under a wrongful conviction. Well, he did get exonerated, so we're going to talk a little bit about that and get some of the accounts from Mr. Ferguson as to how that conviction of Ryan impacted their families or their family. And so we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about that. And then we're also going to share some current events with you. And so let's go on and shift gears and jump into current events.
All righty. And good to be here tonight, Sam. There's some stuff going on, America, that is what we consider off the charts. And this is a story outside of taxes. And let's turn that up a little bit for the folks out there that need a reminder what comes out of Texas. And anybody that's been in America long enough, they'll know that that is about Dallas. The show, but you know what? There was a time in this country when Texas said they are, and nothing going on down there. And, I'm telling you, not going on too well in Texas. We'll start that with current news tonight. Coming out of Texas, the gunfight situation where cops killed out of Waco, Texas. And I'm going to tell you, Sam, Cliff, Lisa, and you folks out there in America, you like to find the days when things are as genuine as apple pie hot dogs and maybe a good food on Saturday or Sunday afternoon. But there's a lot going on, and we're going to get into that now, Sam, as we get ready to dig into this. It says here, per the story, that police in Texas are on alert after two biker gangs involved in a deadly shootout in Waco over the weekend allegedly issued orders to shoot and kill uniformed law enforcement officers. That's pretty serious right there. So, as you know, we talk a lot about terrorist groups in the United States. We talk about ISIS. We talk about these issues that are affecting America right now. But I'll tell you right now, when you got an order or a hit put out to shoot and kill uniformed law enforcement officers, Sam, it kind of gives us in the mindset that where are we at as a country now? We've said it before on this program. Chaos is running wild. I said it last week. Lady Justice has gone missing.
Absolutely.
And I'll tell you straight up, when Lady Justice can't be found, folks tend to try to take the law in their own hands,
yep.
And they seek justice. And it says here that I guess 9 people died as a result of this violence. 18 folks were injured pretty severely. It says law enforcement officers across Texas received memos Monday warning of possible retaliation. A bulletin posted by the Del Rio Sector Border Patrol said members of the COSACs and Bandinos biker gangs had been instructed to shoot and kill uniformed law enforcement officers, according to a CBS affiliate. So as you look at that, Lisa, as we take a look, again, you know, they say all the time, you hear the slogan, no justice, no peace. I think that's coming to fruition right now. Your thoughts on that, Lisa?
Absolutely. I think if the justice system was functioning right now, our justice system is in the toilet. If it was up and functioning, you wouldn't have all these people trying to take things into their own hands and killing police officers. Not that I'm just saying it's justified that they kill cops. I'm not saying that by any means. But you can kind of understand the mentality of people feeling like something has to be done. If law enforcement isn't going to do what's right, if our government isn't going to do what's right, then we need to stand up for ourselves and do what we think is right.
Well, no pun intended in regards to, you said justice is in the toilet. I have news for you. It's already left the pipes. you know, when it's in the, when it happens to be in the toilet area, there's some things that can happen to try to retrieve things. But that gives me an indication it's already left the pipeline and hit the sewage lake.
Yeah, it was flushed a long time ago.
Yeah, this is serious stuff here, man. I mean, you know, and folks, that may sound comical, but I'm going to tell you straight up, it's time that we take a look at what's going on. And I'm going to tell you, we can get upset. And, oh, my God, how could this happen? How is this going on? Until we begin to attack, Sam, you made the statement that this is about bringing the message of justice around the world. So this is not isolated to a city or a state or a county. This thing is infiltrating the United States, and without question, when you have injustice anywhere, it affects justice everywhere, I believe. I quote Dr. Martin Luther King on that statement. So that's one of the stories I think that people need to be concerned about down there in Texas, and as sure as it happens down there, go out to eat on a Sunday afternoon and take mom out there for a piece of apple pie, and I guarantee you somebody may walk in there. That's the threat that we're under, and so it's not just the terrorist issue. We're dealing with the threat of safety, not only of,
right.
that, but of us as a nation as a whole. We're in some serious trouble.
Well, and you know, Lamont, when you look at this type of situation, it only helps to encourage that atmosphere of mistrust or distrust, whichever word you want to pick. And because you know, folks are to that point to where they feel that there is. We're at a breaking point now in this situation with these bikers. you know, they supposedly were coming together to discuss issues that they had among themselves. And then when a fight broke out and then the shooting started, you know, the law enforcement folks were there to hopefully intervene. As a matter of fact, they were there ahead of time because they said that, you know, they knew that the meeting was happening. They tried to discourage the meeting from even happening. And so, you know, the it's certainly a tragic event and a tragic situation that transpired there. But when, you know, the gangs, you know, the aftermath, the gangs put out, you know, a word to shoot anything that's in a uniform, you know, that's a problem. And that's a problem that does, you know, it keeps everyone on edge. And so, like you said, Lamont, you know, this is one of those things that we're going to keep our eye on it and see how this thing transpires. I heard a couple of reports this morning that said that, you know, they don't even know what they're going to do with the hundreds of people that they have locked up. You know, because of the murders that occurred, you know, are you going to bring capital charges against 100 and some folks? They don't know what they're going to do. And so this is just it's a mess. That's what it is.
Absolutely.
Okay, Cliff, I know you had an article that ties directly into a wrongful conviction and the types of things that people run into. And, you know, the system is designed, and we know this, you know, from all the research that we've seen, all the articles that we've read, all the stories that we've heard about, the folks that we've had on air here, as to how the system is designed to stagnate a person's effort to get exonerated. You can have a mound of evidence that points to the fact that a person did not do something, and the unfortunately, prosecutors, certain investigators will do whatever they can in order to maintain that conviction, even though they know that they may or have a man or woman sitting in jail, sitting behind bars in prison, wrongfully convicted. What's the story about, Cliff?
Yeah, this is a story about Jamie Snow. Some out there may be familiar with him. You know, he was convicted in 2001 for a 1991 murder of a man named William Little. Little was a victim of an apparent robbery while working as a gas station attendant in Bloomington, Illinois. And Jamie Snow has always maintained his innocence. He says he was at home eating dinner with his family at the time of the murder, and he's currently serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole. But when you look into the facts of this case, it really is, you know, just disgusting from a prosecutorial misconduct, from a Brady Act violation. I mean, just lying witness, eyewitnesses that all of their testimony has basically been found to be a lie. And what this article says is that the prosecution presented eyewitnesses who claimed to see Snow leaving the scene, and also a series of jailhouse snitches who claimed that Snow confessed to them that he had committed the crime. New evidence is now available that highlights many inconsistencies in the eyewitness statements, and numerous jailhouse snitches have now recanted. Now, if you say we took the eyewitness testimony, we found out that they're either confused, blatantly lied, or mistaken about what they saw, and then you take 8 jailhouse snitches and you take their testimony and tear it down, and they still, the crazy part about this case, it's not about, okay, the court has said, no, this new testimony is not good. They're saying they're not even going to look at this new evidence, not new testimony, but new evidence about what this attorney found. And the attorney is Tara Thompson. She's with the University of Chicago's Exoneration Project. She is representing Jamie Snow. And she says this is a case where new evidence was presented, and the court said don't even bother bringing it in the door. So they haven't had a hearing about even bringing the new testimony forward. And the eyewitness, Martinez, he says that he saw Jamie Snow on the night of the murder. But the problem with Martinez's testimony, heard 8 years after the crime, completely contradicts previous statement that he has made, is what this article is saying. It says Martinez was given multiple opportunities to identify Snow early on, but he never did. On the night of the murder, Martinez viewed mugshots and suspect books and couldn't identify Snow. He narrowed it down to 2 men that were not Snow and stated it's between these two. No information that ever been released that clears the two men that Martinez identified. Martinez later viewed a physical lineup that included Snow and could not make a positive IED. And then this part just gets really crazy. Like you said earlier, Mont, a polygraph test isn't really admissible as evidence because, you know, all the flaws in polygraph tests and people have learned how to get by them. But basically what this attorney is saying is that if in these polygraph tests that it exposes other exculpatory evidence, then they at least had the right to see them. But a polygraph test, which was never given to Snow's defense team, has notes showing that Martinez specifically stated that Snow was not the person he saw at the service station. This wow. is the eyewitness. The eyewitness is now saying, no, it wasn't this guy. He's not the one that I saw. And when all this stuff came before a judge, a three-panel judge, one of the judges, Judge Stegman, questions the state's shaky position, stating, and because the state is saying, well, the fact that he said that that's not that it wasn't Jamie Snow, he was saying that that wasn't him in the lineup. And so the judge comes back to the prosecutor, Judge Stegman. He questioned the state's shaky position, stating, quote, so the witness failed to identify petitioner in the lineup within a few weeks of the crime. And then 3 years later, when this polygram exam is taken, the note in the margin says that Martinez says petitioner is not the person he saw. And your description of that is that refers to the lineup. That's what the judge is asking. Like, prosecutor, come on, you can't just make up stuff and try to twist the facts to go in your position. But it says the state has now attempted to change the narrative by claiming Martinez was never an important witness and his testimony wouldn't have changed anything. But what goes on top of, they had 8 jailhouse snitches.
8.
And they discredit all of their testimony. The first one, Kevin Shaw, he denied he received a deal, but records show that he got an early departure from prison for providing information valuable to a murder case. Another snitch, Ronnie Wright, admitted in a sworn affidavit that he and Snow had gotten into an argument over a card game, and he was angry. So he said, all the testimony implicating Jamie Snow that I gave at the trial was a lie. I was mad at Jamie and wanted to get even for what had previously happened in county jail. I was able to answer all of the prosecutor's questions with detail because I had read all of the discovery material. So he's letting a snitch give him the discovery material and then get up on the stand and testify. He's like, well, yeah, I know everything about the case. The prosecutor gave me all the discovery. Then they had another one, Ed Palomo. He admitted on the stand that he was trying to get a deal. Palomo later stated in a sworn affidavit that he was threatened by the state's attorney, stating, if I didn't testify, I would be put in segregation in prison, be charged with perjury, or get 5 years in prison for not cooperating. Palumbo also stated that the prosecutor, Charles Raynard, told him that Snow did not commit the crime someone else had, but since they couldn't get that other person, Jamie would have to do. It's ridiculous, and this just goes on and on.
How can people get away with that?
It's ridiculous.
Well, I can tell you how. They've been enabled to get away with it.
Yeah.
That's the system in which we are in. And as long as you allow and not speak up that this is unacceptable, people will continue to just create. It's kind of like a culture that's in place, and we continue to mold and to shape that culture
right.
into a mad situation, and that's actually what it is.
And, I mean, they go on, but there's just crazy things in here. You have that one of the snitches, he agreed to testify after being put in segregation as a means to get him to cooperate. He stated that he agreed to testify to stop the harassment. They continued to harass him. Then he said, when the reporter asked the state, he said, I was surprised to hear the state's response to allegations that snitches received deals. And what I can only describe it as an odd event, the state read off a list of jailhouse informants that received deals after they testified against Snow. It appears the goal was to show that the deals came after testimony, so the witnesses had no idea that they would be receiving anything in advance. This is a ridiculous argument. So they all got deals for telling lies. And then the prosecutor's position is, no, they didn't get the deals until after they did their testimony. So they didn't know it was going to be a deal. Full of crap. It's like you are full of crap.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're just getting started here. And I can tell you hear the music, you hear the tone. What does that sound like to you, America? It sounds like someone is looking for justice. Folks, get the kids to bed, tuck them in, with depending on where you are across the United States. Sam Thurman, Lisa Stewart, Cliff Stewart, I'm Lamont Banks. We're coming right back at you. Let's get started. Right back.
Hey guys, I'm Jordan Sparks.
I'm Chase Crawford.
Hey, what's up? It's Usher.
Hi, I'm Rachel Bilson.
I'm Hayden Christensen.
I'm Peyton Manning.
Hey, we're Fall Out Boy.
I'm Dude Archuleta.
I'm Corbin Blue.
I'm Kristen Bell.
And we're the Jonas Brothers.
Do something good for your community.
Reuse bags and bottles and always recycle.
Help us collect 1 million pounds of food.
Helps people prepare for a natural disaster.
Do something about homelessness.
Anyone could be a rock star in their community.
So then do something.
Do something.
Do something.
Do something.
Visit dosomething.org to find out how.
Talk about it.
I've got to go home.
Oh, come on, Carrie. We're going to a new place.
She wants to go home, right? Go.
Whoa. You okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm fine.
You sure?
Relax. What's a few beers?
If you don't stop your friend from drinking and driving, you're as good as dead. Drinking and driving can kill a friendship.
Can you imagine spending 20 years of your life in prison for a crime you didn't commit? Neither could I, until I got the opportunity to portray Betty Ann Waters in the film Conviction, telling the real story of how she freed her brother Kenny. Sadly, what happened to Kenny happens far more often than you might expect, but together we can stop it. Please join me in helping the Innocence Project fight injustice. Go to innocenceproject.org to make a donation and get involved.
Thanks for listening to AJC Radio. Call in at 347-838-8976 and share your stories and comments about judicial injustice. Be a part of the AJC Radio Show every Tuesday and Thursday night, 6 p.m. Mountain, 8 p.m. Eastern. The number again, 347-838-8976 or www.blogtalkradio.com and search for A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
My boyfriend dumped me, I still have to finish my research project, and my parents' divorce is tearing me apart.
Does this sound like you?
I just feel hopeless.
Someone is always there to help. Don't give up. When you feel like you don't belong, talk about it. Never keep things locked inside. If you need help, please call the suicide hotline number 1-800-273-8255. Your life matters. Don't give up.
Ladies and gentlemen of America, we find ourselves in a precarious situation as America, its citizens, stand at the crossroads of decision. Well, AJC Radio is committed. Coming June 4th, 2015, every Thursday evening, we will introduce a new campaign entitled Spotlight on Capitol Hill. The purpose of this campaign is to take each and every Thursday, we will spotlight a member of Congress and the initiatives that are important not only to them, but to their constituents and the nation and this country as a whole. Our purpose is to shine the light on congressmen, senators, men and women who are committed to the oath that they took when they were elected to public office. We find it very important that we would shine the light on something that is positive in a time of critical challenges that face this nation. So I invite you tonight to join us beginning June 4th, every Thursday, as we introduce Spotlight on Capitol Hill. As all Americans are trying to do, we are seeking justice. Join us for an exciting time of highlighting your congressman and your senator, that we might come together as a people and as a nation to bring about change. We look forward to you joining us June 4th and every Thursday thereafter. God bless you and God bless America.
Just Cause Radio, bringing the message of justice around the world. My thanks to Stuart, Lisa Stuart. I'm Sam Thurman. We'd like to encourage our listeners throughout the week to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and if you were listening to that promo just a moment ago, you can go to our websites, and that's a-justcause.com. Again, www.a-justcause.com or www.ajcradio.com. Our websites are being revamped, and you can see a lot of good information about the Thursday spotlights that we're going to be providing as far as the spotlight on Capitol Hill. That's going to be some good stuff. Lamont, our phone number this evening is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. I was getting ready to ask you a question.
Well, along with that, you know, we want to definitely let the listeners know that encourage them to go out. Those of you that are online tonight, you may get best results from listening to the program. Actually, using Google Chrome has been proven to show some better results. So if you're having any issues on Explorer or any other browsers and you're just getting frustrated out there, go ahead and try to log on through Google Chrome as your browser, and you're going to get the best results probably of this program and future programs and archives and all that good stuff right there, okay?
Excellent. Cliff, I know you found another article. We were going to try and touch on that really quick before we move to our subject matter for the evening and reach out to our special guest. What's that article about?
Yeah, we have this Ohio prisoner who represents himself and beats an attempted murder charge in the court. Things like this are, you know, pretty close to our heart because they show a lot of what we represent here as a just cause, that a person can represent themselves, and if the process is allowed to play out properly, you can actually see where, you know, when the evidence is presented by both sides and the judge sits back and plays referee instead of interfering like Judge Christine Arguello did in the IRP 6 case, that you actually can have justice served. This Ohio prisoner, his name is Cornelius, a.k.a. Soha Harris. He's serving a 97-year prison at the Ohio State Penitentiary in Youngstown. He argued to a jury himself that ongoing abuse by prison guards left him no choice but to fight back. He says, "I've been in prison for a long time now. I've never expected prison to be easy," he said in his opening arguments, "but the way I've been treated by guards has crossed the line to inhumane." How many times have we heard this by just about everybody who's ever spent any time locked up, that the guards feel like it is their position to hand down the punishment? Is punishment enough that a person is locked up? Their freedom's been taken away. They've been separated from their family. They're locked up. They don't have any exposure to the outside world. They're locked behind bars. And then the prison guards want to take it upon themselves to mistreat them. Well, Mr. Harris said, you know, after firing his attorney, the article says, rather, his attorney was Mark Lavelle, who sat in the court gallery during the trial. Harris chose to defend himself, cross-examining witnesses, presenting video evidence, and as one reporter put it, offering an occasional rant against the prison system. Well, if you lock me up for 97 years, I think I have the right to rant. You know, I'm doing my time. As long as I'm not breaking any laws, everything is good. It says, in describing the jury surveillance video from 2009 and 10 that showed him fighting with guards and allegedly pushing one guard down a flight of stairs, Harris admitted that the video showed him acting out, but argued the guards had instigated the violence. Harris, who's been incarcerated since 2007, has been held as a maximum security level 5 prisoner in solitary since the fights with the guards that prompted the attempted murder and assault charge. He's confined to a cell 23 hours a day, and his access to visitors, commissary, and programming is restricted, if not entirely prohibited, under some circumstances. According to Harris, however, he hasn't had an incident report in 3 years. So on February 8th, after 35 days on his hunger strike — that's a long time without your meals, but he's got a point to prove — the 12-person jury found Harris not guilty of one count of attempted murder and 3 counts of felonious assault, sparing him from spending an additional 71 years in prison. Two counts of attempted aggravated murder were reduced to felonious assault, and he was also found guilty of 3 counts of possession of a dangerous weapon. But see, all of this, he was pushed to this point by the guards, and a jury
agrees with him. You were pushed to this point by guards mistreating you, abusing you, and taking it upon themselves to deal out punishment.
Here's what's bizarre to me, if I heard it right. The gentleman is serving 97 years.
97 years.
So let the jury know that if there was questionable behavior or questionable questions raised whether he was guilty of this or not, they came back with the not guilty. My question is that, and this is another show, Sam and Lisa and Cliff, as we go forward, that we talked about how juries many times will come with a conviction of something based upon the fact that, well, you're here, we're going to convict you of something. Right. We're not going to say murder. Well, the gentleman is looking. He is sitting. Sir, he would never have. Here's what gets me about this, and I'm sorry if my words are a little tied up. You are doing 97 years.
Right.
You're not doing an additional 71 regardless because you're not going to be here.
No.
The problem I have is that it goes back to what we talked about, juries and how they are persuaded and the culture of a courtroom by a judge. And I can tell you whether they ever admit it or not, if they knew this man was already an existing prisoner,
mm-hmm.
they were coming back with something. So if you don't think I did it purposely to kill this man, how are you charging me with felonious murder? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it's like you give me felonious assault, but you just said that I did it basically in self-defense. You said I was defending myself.
Exactly right.
But then you give me felonious assault. That's a contradiction.
That's my point.
And that's exactly right. It's like, well, you're in prison for something else anyway. You did. Yeah. You may not have tried to kill this guard, but you did something.
You did assault him probably because you do have a record.
Always something you never. Yeah, it's like you got a record.
So
we're not gonna let you off just because the facts say that you did it in self defense. It's a sickening system.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's shift gears and go to our main subject of the evening. We're going to talk about how wrongful convictions impact families. And listeners, again, we'd like to encourage you to join in on the conversation. If you have any questions or comments about this, please give us a call at 347-838-8976. Again, 347-838-8976. Or you can also chime in on the chat room or in the chat room online, and we'll monitor that for questions or comments that may come in. Joining us now is Bill Ferguson, who is the father of Ryan Ferguson, who was wrongfully convicted of a murder that he did not commit. Mr. Ferguson, welcome to A Just Cause Radio. How are you doing this evening?
Doing great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us again. And we've had you on the program before to talk about Ryan's case. But in this situation, we wanted to dive a little bit more into the subject of how it impacts families. And I know you and your family fought tirelessly on Ryan's behalf, along with a lot of other folks, in order to execute his exoneration. And that's something that's important. A lot of times, you know, people go to prison and they are left to fend for themselves. They have no support. They have no one to fight for them while they're incarcerated. And as we know all too well, that when a person is incarcerated, the system is designed to strip them of their voice. It's designed to strip them of having any connection with the outside. So, Mr. Ferguson, tell us a little bit about Ryan's story and how, and then we'll get into some dialogue as to how it impacted your family.
Well, I'm not exactly sure where to start, but he, November 2001, Halloween night, a murder took place here in Columbia, Missouri. And about 2.5 years after that, Ryan and another young man were arrested and ultimately convicted of the murder of this particular individual, Ken Heichel. And it was proven later that they could not have committed the murder.
And I know that I think in this situation, the conviction was based solely on the testimony of two witnesses who later recanted their stories. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
And how long from that, them recanting their stories, did it take to go through the system to get Ryan released from this wrongful conviction?
About about a year, year and a half, something like that. That's a good question. I never looked at the number of months because whenever the when they recanted their testimony, I think it's the first time in the history of jurisprudence in the United States where you actually had two witnesses admit on the witness stand that they lied. I think that's the first time that's ever happened. A lot of times witnesses will admit that they have lied, but it's in a deposition or it's in a court motion or something like that. But to actually be in a live court with a judge on television admitting that they committed perjury, knowing, and this is the important part, I think, knowing that they could be charged with perjury and go to and receive a long prison sentence for that. And still, they admitted that they lied and that the prosecutor manipulated them and forced them into that lie.
Wow. So, Mr. Ferguson, as a father, when Ryan was first implicated in this horrific crime and arrested, what did that do to you as a father when you saw that your son was picked up as a teenager? He was still a teen at that time, right?
That is correct. Yes, he was 19 yeah. years old. Well, it was devastating. I've been through a lot in my life. You know, I'm an old guy, so I've experienced a lot. And but I had not ever had anything that would prepare me for that. That was beyond my wildest imagination that, or any parent's wildest imagination, that their child would be arrested for murder. It's beyond comprehension. And so it took me, I'd say, about 24 hours before I regained my senses. It's like playing football and getting the breath knocked out of you. It takes you a little while to recover. But once I did recover, I realized that I'm going to have to learn a lot about law enforcement and investigating and get my hands on the discovery and find out all the information I possibly can to help free my son.
And Mr. Ferguson, Lamont Banks here, and I let me first apologize for what you have gone through by a system that, as we say on this program, has lost her way. My apologies for that type of trauma. I was one that was wrongfully convicted here in the state of Colorado, did 7 years for something that I did not do. In my particular case, one of the witnesses got on the stand and admitted that she had lied and that she was coerced into lying by an older sister. So how you come back with a conviction, it keeps you. That's what causes you to scratch your head a little bit and see how is this even possible. My question for you is, as you have gone through this, and it may be an answer that we expect, but what are your thoughts about the judicial system now? As my mother raised me growing up, that if you do it the right way, if you go, you know, listen and obey the laws of the land, you don't have to worry about something bad happening to you. What are your thoughts and your faith in a system that has touched you so close to home?
Well, it has shaken my confidence in the system. At the same time, I've shocked people by saying that I think we do have the best justice system in the world. I really do believe that. But at the same time, it's only as good as the people that are administrating it. And the most powerful administrator in the judicial system is not the judge, in my opinion. It's the prosecutor. He's the one that brings the charges. He's the one that handles the evidence. He's the one that controls the whole thing. The judges, I don't think, have that much power, and the juries have no idea what's going on. And it really comes down to a personality contest between the defense attorney and the prosecutor, and the ability of the prosecutor to lie, manipulate, and cover up evidence. That's why you have so many Brady violations.
And Bill, I'll politely agree to disagree to a point of what you're saying in regards to the system. You know, given the statistics that we have seen, I believe the judge has a lot of power because it is his job to stop a prosecutor from doing those things that are, whether they're inappropriate, whether these folks crossed the line of law in the events that they did, where evidence was covered up. There are hearings and things that are set in place. before a case even gets to trial for a judge to rule, do we have sufficient evidence to proceed forward with trial here? So I believe, again, I'll agree to disagree on that point. I do not believe on any case that we have the best system in the world when we have a lady in Iran who was in solitary confinement, I believe, in Iran, and stated that she was treated better there than she was in the United States. I don't believe we have the best system. I believe the system has broken and it has failed, and the numbers support that. The largest incarceration rate of any country in the world, the United States holds that record. Those are records that are not proud to be held, and I think we're in bad shape. I think the corruption starts from the time the handcuffs get on you. We've seen that with police brutality. We've seen it with arrests. We've seen it with harassment. We've seen it to the point where innocent people have died. That's just to answer your response to that. I have to again agree to disagree on that one, Sam.
Well, you know, I think when I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mr. Ferguson. You were getting ready to make a comment.
Well, I cannot disagree with what was just said. Absolutely, but I'm talking about the framework of the justice system, the way it was created initially. If we would adhere to the way it was brought about via the Constitution, we have the best system. Now, if you have prosecutors, judges, and so on and so forth not doing their job, well, then it's going to be terrible. And you're right. We do have more people in prison than any other country. There's no excuse for that. And there's no excuse for judges currently and prosecutors to behave the way they have been. And the judicial system has to take the initiative to punish those prosecutors. And I'll tell you one thing. If they would arrest and convict and put a couple of these prosecutors and policemen in prison for a significant amount of time, you will see a drastic change in the legal system.
And, Mr. Ferguson, I do agree with you on that. I just wanted to say that. You're right. If it was ran the way it was intended, and you're absolutely right on that. So we'll both agree to agree that is the case.
I like that.
Okay, so that makes perfect sense. And like you said, if it was ran how it was intended, we'd be in good shape. But the problem is, like you said, we have flawed people sitting in those positions that are becoming more and more corrupt every day. Thank you, sir.
And we say often on this show, Mr. Ferguson, that, you know, that is the issue. The prosecutor, mostly the prosecutor, because when it got to him, if you had corrupt police, if you had police that arrested people for whatever type of wrong reasons, racial profiling, they're just looking for a scapegoat or whatever. If when it came to the prosecutor and he did his due diligence, he did his research and found out, you know what, the evidence does not support the fact that this individual was arrested in the first place or charged with this crime. We need to, you know, basically do something about that. Go to the police officers, and if you find that they're corrupt, bring charges against them. But the prosecutor, because they have this blanket, you know, just immunity, that anything that they do during the course of their job, they cannot be, you know, no action can be brought against them. That is what has to change. If we say, okay, not only civilly, but criminally, a prosecutor can be gone after for prosecutorial misconduct if they violate a Brady, the Brady bill, which they do constantly. If they hide evidence, if they coerce witnesses to say things that are not true, to get on the stand and actually lie, then have to come back and say, you know what, I'm up here to say that I lied at the behest of the prosecutor. If the prosecutor was gone after for things of that nature, and of course the judge would have to be the one to really enforce that, then we would see a change in how, as you say, how the system of the Constitution is applied to our everyday citizens. If the same rule applied to the prosecutor, judges, police officers, everybody across the board, then perhaps the system would work. It would work much better, is my opinion. But since you give these prosecutors basically an above-the-law card, they do whatever they want to, and they get away with it because they know that they're going to get away with it, and therein lies the problem.
Well, it really boils down to accountability.
Yes. Yeah.
And you know, that is what we're talking about in the sense of when prosecutors, investigators have this blanket immunity to just strip people of their lives, even though they know that the person is innocent, then therein lies a major issue. I mean, they are allowed to put people in prison. They're allowed to go about their lives and withhold evidence, yet they know that they're doing that. And then, you know, the end result comes down to what we're talking about tonight. It impacts that person. They're stripped out of society. They are not able to maintain their life that they once knew. And then it impacts their families. Lamont.
You're absolutely right. This conversation gets more and more intriguing, if you will. Mr. Ferguson, if you can hold on to the other side of this break, we'd love to bring you back and continue to get your insight of what has happened to you and your personal experience. Can you come back with us?
Absolutely.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is a Just Cause Radio, AJC Radio, excuse me, where we are actually in search for justice, bringing the message of justice around the world. Folks, it's going to do nothing but get better from here. Tuck little Johnny into bed. It's 9 o'clock on the East Coast. He needs his rest. And tuck little Susie in. Maybe go grab a cup of coffee. Parents in the living room. And we're going to be back to the kit to continue this discussion. For Sam Lamont here, Cliff, Lisa Stewart, don't go nowhere. We'll be right back.
We have a big problem, and we need your help.
It's happening on college campuses, at bars, at parties, even in high schools.
It's happening to our sisters and our daughters.
Our wives and our friends.
It's called sexual assault, and it has to stop. We have to stop it. So listen up.
If she doesn't consent, or if she can't consent, it's rape, it's assault.
It's a crime. It's wrong.
If I saw it happening, I was taught you have to do something about it.
If I saw it happening, I speak up.
If I saw it happening, I'd never blame her. I'd help her.
Because I don't want to be a part of the problem. I want to be a part of the solution.
We need all of you to be part of the solution. This is about respect. It's about responsibility.
It's up to all of us to put an end to sexual assault. And that starts with you.
Because one is too many.
Here are 50 white guys. Here are 50 black guys. Here's how many white guys can expect to go to prison in their lifetime. The chances amount to 1 out of 17. Now, here's how many black guys can expect the same thing. The chances are 1 out of 3. Why? Lots of reasons. It's complicated, but one thing is clear. There's a racial bias at every level of the criminal justice system. When blacks and whites commit the same kind of crimes, blacks are more likely to be arrested. Once arrested, they're more likely to be convicted. Once convicted, they're more likely to serve longer sentences. Look at the numbers in America's so-called war on drugs. About 14% of America's drug users are black, as are about a quarter of drug sellers. Yet blacks are 34% of people arrested for drug crimes. And those convicted of drug crimes, 46% are black. By the time we factor in sentencing, there are actually more black drug offenders than white ones in state prison and federal prison. In the end, the incarceration rate for drug crimes is 10 times higher for blacks than it is for whites. These are the facts. Racial disparities in America's war on drugs are one big reason that one of three black men can expect to go to prison in their lifetime.
AJC Radio, bringing the message of justice around the world. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Our phone number this evening, 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Lamont, who's lost?
Lady Justice, there's a bit of search warrant or a bench warrant issued for your arrest to come back home. And ladies and gentlemen, we need Lady Justice back. And she definitely is missing. Mr. Ferguson, thanks for coming back with us. And definitely in your case, Lady Justice was missing for quite some time. And gratefully, there was a way that justice was found in your son's case. Sam?
So, Mr. Ferguson, let's talk a little bit about how, you know, before the break, we talked about, you know, being a father and how it impacted you when Ryan was first arrested. And then to have to spend so many years in prison. People don't realize the psychological, the physical, the financial, all of the burden that a family may encounter. You know, sometimes I think we talk about it here on the program a lot of times, and we refer to it as, you know, out of sight, out of mind. People take a complacent perspective when it comes to someone being incarcerated. You know, while the story is hot, you hear it on the news, and if you may even be personally connected to someone, and after the conviction, then it's, oh, well, you know, did you hear that Ryan went to prison? And I'm sure you probably dealt a little bit with that you had two camps. You had the camp that says Ryan was convicted, but we know he didn't do anything. Hey, Bill, we're here for you. Whatever you need, let us know. We're going to stand by you. Then you got the other camp that says, well, I knew that Ryan was going to eventually get into something that he couldn't get himself out of. Am I far off the mark there?
That is true. That is the perception that people have. But we did come up with a new term, kind of a new lexicon of terms, and one of them is a cognitive dissonance. And that is when you're first arrested, they usually find the most unflattering photograph they can find, and that's what's in the newspaper. Then the newspaper and the media, they put out a story. But that story comes from the police, and it comes from the authorities. And then the person being accused, there's no way for them to say anything. And the first time you ever get to hear them say anything is actually during the trial, if they're lucky. Now, cognitive dissonance comes in whenever the person is exonerated, 5, 6, 10, 15, 20 years later. There's that core of people still believe the person's guilty because that's what they first heard whenever the arrest took place before the defendant could defend themselves. And so cognitive dissonance means that even though you're confronted with the truth, you still believe what you first heard. And I think that addresses what you're talking about.
Well, and you know, Lamont, if you don't mind, you know, you experienced something very similar to what Mr. Ferguson is stating here when you, during the jury selection in your trial.
Yeah, and I'll share it with our listeners, and Mr. Ferguson, I'll share this with you. When we came in for jury selection, my attorney stood up, about 60 folks sitting in the courtroom that day, trying to get a jury selected for my trial. And my defense attorney did something very, very smart. He raised the question. He asked the question to the jurors, potential jurors, that if how many people believe that Mr. Banks is guilty right now, before any evidence goes on, before anything, how many people believe Mr. Banks has to be guilty of something? Every person and every jury in that room raised their hand. Now, that is very disheartening for the person sitting in the defendant's chair because it seems impossible at that point that you're going to get a fair trial. The judge ended up having to call each individual potential juror into separate hearings, if you will, to question them that Mr. Banks hasn't been convicted of anything. You guys are saying he's guilty and not one piece of evidence or testimony has actually been provided in the case. I would call that pretty disheartening, would you?
I'm going to bet that judge had a little talk with that defense attorney after that. That's pretty embarrassing for the court.
Well, I think in this particular case, the judge was pretty much, he was very concerned. He was one that was concerned about a right to a fair trial. His concern was that, goodness.
Good.
Yeah, so, you know, he took the time to individually pull these people in with the defense and the prosecution there to say, can you objectively give Mr. Banks a fair trial based upon your hand going up 5 minutes ago? And he took the time to do it. So in his case, and it's sad to say, those type of situations seem to be rare in our justice system now, but in his case, he took the time because he said he did not want to put a trial on where a preconceived notion of guilt was already in place.
Well, that's very rare. That's good on that judge. Maybe that judge will become contagious.
We would need that to happen.
So, Mr. Ferguson, do you have any other children?
I do. I have a daughter who's 5 years older than Ryan.
And so what kind of things, what were some of the signs or impact to your daughter seeing her younger brother being wrongfully convicted and incarcerated? What type of things does she have to deal with?
Well, all of us, I think, probably suffered the same degree of humiliation and shock, so on and so forth, that any family would. So she just, you know, just once she got over the shock, just came to me and said, "What can we do to help Ryan? Because I know he's not guilty." And so she just dug in, and she helped me do a lot of the research to find witnesses and to read police reports and to look at the evidence. And so that's how she dealt with that situation. You know, she didn't feel sorry for herself, didn't feel sorry for Ryan. We just said, you know, we just got to get busy and find the truth. And that's what she did.
And Mr. Ferguson, how did your wife handle that with her son going through all that, with her younger son going through that? How did that affect her?
Exactly the same way. We all collectively as a family just said, okay, this has been done. We know it's wrong. What can we do to help our attorneys free Ryan? And so, I'm helping other parents that are going through this. But one of the things you have to do as a parent, you have to get your hands on the discovery. Now, lawyers don't want you to get a hold of the discovery. They want to keep the discovery far away from you. That's one way you can sort of keep an eye on them to see if they're doing their job. So you've got to get a hold of discovery. And then once you get the discovery, you've got to read every syllable of it. You've got to create a flow chart and an outline and go through and put it all together, find all the witnesses, go through and scrutinize everything. Because as a family member, and that's the advantage of Kelly and Leslie, being able to help me go through every single piece of that evidence, and we create a matrix of witnesses and testimony, and then by doing that, we are able to find the truth. And the truth of the matter is that lawyers, no matter how good they are, and prosecuting attorneys, they don't have the luxury of time to go through and look at it to the degree that a family member can, because we have the time. We only have one case. They have lots of cases. And so that's the key. If you want to help a loved one, get the family members onto the case, have read every syllable, work together, be coordinated, and only make statements that are documented. So that's kind of long-winded. That's what we do.
And, you know, Mr. Ferguson, as you're aware, a little while ago, we had you and Ryan on our program talking about his case. And we pulled a clip of Ryan from our archives. We're going to take just a moment here and play that clip, and then we're going to come back to you. Let's play that clip.
Figure things out.
And how do you not be bitter if you're not?
It's difficult not to be bitter, but we look at the reality of what happened, and we ask for accountability. And we move forward, and we believe that in the future, you know, people will be held accountable for what they did to myself and to my family. And you just really hope that happens, and you live life.
Yeah, but you can't put a money value on what happened to you.
There is no monetary value to 10 years of life. My whole 20s are gone, and I can't get that back. But I have a great family, like I was talking about, and we're going to move forward together and do great things together.
So that was actually from CBS Morning where Ryan was on. But, you know, he was just talking about how, you know, those types, when a situation like this happens, those are years that are lost. You can't get back. And it's not, as we stated earlier, it's not just Ryan who lost those years, but Ryan's dad, his mom, his sister, other family members, other friends lost all those years that, as we talked about before, someone should be accountable. Now, you know, Mr. Ferguson, as we, you know, we're dealing with one of the cases here that's the IRP 6, and, you know, you have six gentlemen who are wrongfully convicted and have been incarcerated now for 3 years. And, you know, they have children that are involved. The physical impact on the children and the psychological impact on the children is tremendous. People do not think about that when a person is wrongfully convicted. Now, as we look at this situation, you have a young girl that's the daughter of one of the IRP6. I believe, how old was she, like 13 or 12 when she was diagnosed with high blood pressure?
She was 14.
14? You know, a 14-year-old with high blood pressure? I mean, that's phenomenal. And then not to even think about the trauma of going to school and having to, you know, you have those school functions where you're around other kids and dad is showing up for field day or what have you, and you're having to try and explain away where your dad is. You know, so the types of impact that it has to a family is tremendous. Now, Mr. Ferguson, as far as re-indoctrinating into society, how has Ryan adjusted, and what are the types of things that he's doing now, now that he has been exonerated?
Well, he's, I think, made a great transition, but from the time he was arrested, we started working as a family, working with him, because we knew we were going to get him out. We didn't know how long. We never dreamed it would take 10 years, but we knew he was going to get out, and we wanted him to be prepared when he did get out, because he was only 19 years old when he went in, and we wanted him to have a positive attitude, and he does have. Every time we'd see him, he'd always greet us with a big hug and a smile. He was always upbeat and positive, and now that he is out, he's helping other people gain their freedom. We're going through cases. We just don't support just anybody. We go through and we look at the trial transcript, the discovery, and when we find a case, which is pretty easy to do actually, we find a case and then we support it. And we're working on three cases right now that we're supporting. I wish we could do more, but it's just so time consuming. And the thing is, like someone mentioned before, might have been Lamont, is that once the handcuffs get on, it's not about justice. It's all about the conviction. And it just takes one prosecutor, one evil prosecutor, to put you in prison, and it takes an army to get you out.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Mr. Ferguson, a question for you as far as the way that this has impacted your family and your children. I know that you said that as far as the way that you look at the justice system, that it's not the same as it was before Ryan went in. And a lot of times we talk to people and they say, yeah, you know, once it happens to you, once it comes home and you start to do your research, you start to dig in and learn about the justice system, learn about laws and law enforcement, then it really hits you in a different way. How have you basically, you know, Ryan said it's hard not to be bitter, but how have you kept him or tried to give him the concept that, you know, the justice system, if done right, can work? How have you given him and his sister, you know, kind of that encouragement to not to give up on the system?
Well, that's just the way they are. They're strong, independent people, and we just know that's just the way life is. So we're going to fight through it, and one of the ways we're fighting through it is that I love these kinds of programs. I mean, you know, a lot of people are just indifferent to the plight that other people are going through. You know, mm-hmm. whether they're no matter what they're going through, illness or being falsely accused or whatever it happens to be. But what we're going to do is go a step beyond, and we're talking to our state legislators now, and ideally we'd like to talk to every single state representative in Missouri to remove that immunity banner that you see over the prosecutors. That needs to be removed, and the way to remove that is through legislation, and the legislators are light years away from the reality of what's going on. And that doesn't even touch them. So we're going to go around and other people as well and talk to these legislators and slowly bring this about. I mean, when you look at civil rights, how long that took for that to come about. You know, even even in 1870 when black men were given the right to vote, most times they didn't get the right to vote. And here we had to pass the civil rights law by the federal government in 1964 and still tough to vote. Well, that's what it is with these prosecutors. You just got to keep fighting and fighting and fighting it. And you have to do it through legislation. So you can have these radio programs. We can have marches. We can have banners. We can complain. We can do whatever we want to do. But the only way we're going to bring about change is through legislation. We've got to all get together and legislate change and take away this prosecutorial immunity. At least that's my opinion.
And Bill Lamont here, I actually agree with that. I will say this, and to listening America out there, that, you know, like I think the point you made, the issues that we're faced with are going to require that we take you know what, be honest with you, there has to be a common sense look at prosecutorial immunity. Just the common sense side of that. You got this country, the tone of the country right now is that, you know what, we don't believe in them, they don't believe in us, so you know what, we're just going to be at war until a revolution breaks out here, and we're going to have a major, major problem going on in this country. So my thought is the same as yours, is that it takes people coming together, talking and saying, look, we have to force this thing, because if we don't, our young people are going to continue to get to die. We're going to continue to have the highest incarceration rate in the world. We're going to continue to have people. When I think about your son, 9 years and 8 months of his life gone, taken away from him.
Yeah.
7 years of my life.
Yeah.
You can never give me that back. Thank God in my situation, I didn't have to bury my mother during that time.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have been able to say farewell to my mother or to my siblings. I was fortunate. But that's Russian roulette, man, because at the end of the day, anything could have happened during that 7 years or that 9 years or that 1 year. I think sometimes we may get hung up, Bill and Sam and Lisa and Cliff, maybe on the numbers. You know, 6 months locked up away from your loved ones. The tears that mother will cry at
That's
night,
right.
Wishing that her son was home. Bill, the tears you shed through dealing with the fact, man, I want to help my son. I've never felt like a sense of hopelessness and helplessness that a person has to feel when their loved one is locked up and I can't just go to that gate and say, come on, you're going home. The people need to take a look at that. It is a suffering. It is a serious thing here when you take a man's liberty, let alone you take it from a man who would never did anything.
Well, you know, Lamont, just thinking about what you were just talking about, Columbia University did a study. And they said that just looking at those who have been exonerated, not the ones who are still incarcerated, who we know that there are thousands that are still incarcerated who are innocent, but of those that have been exonerated, over 10,000 combined years spent behind bars. 10,000.
Did you say 10,000 years?
Of all the people that have been exonerated. If you look at all the time that they spent behind bars, wrongfully convicted, it adds up to over 10,000 years.
That's B.C., ladies and gentlemen. B.C.
That's crazy.
Are you kidding me right now? That is unbelievable right now.
That's very thought-provoking, because when you look at that and you say, okay, this is how many years that basically – now, this isn't – saying, okay, the people in prison that are spending time, this is the amount of people who have been exonerated. You're talking about
exactly
10,000 years wasted.
Wow.
Of wasted time that these families, these exonerees, the friends, the loved ones, you cannot get that back. You can't get back the people, like you say, Lamont, that passed away while these people sat behind bars for absolutely no reason. This is time, just years and lives that have been totally wasted away. You know, it makes absolutely no sense for the system to basically, how do we say this does not need to be revamped? How does anybody look at it and say there is not a problem with the U.S. judicial system? 10,000 wasted years?
10,000 combined years spent behind bars.
How many lifetimes or generations of that?
Gosh.
Wow.
I mean, you know, Mr. Ferguson, I think it goes back to what you were saying earlier, that these prosecutors, investigators, those who are instrumental in putting people in prison, wrongfully convicting them, wrongfully incarcerating them, they need to have that immunity veil lifted off of them, and they need to spend time in prison. And, you know, let's see how many combined years of prison time we can find for prosecutors who wrongfully, knowingly wrongfully convict people and withhold evidence and so forth. I mean, Mr. Ferguson, you hit the nail on the head on that. It's about accountability. And these folks need to feel some of the pain. I mean, when was there a prosecutor? Where was that that district attorney or state attorney who decided, that was here in the state of Colorado, wasn't it? Where he didn't even spend
right, yeah, I think
24
so.
Hours, or did he?
Yeah, that he spent, are you talking about the one in solitary confinement?
Yes.
Yeah, that was here in Colorado. He spent overnight in solitary confinement and said he felt like he was
losing his mind.
He was losing his mind, totally going insane in less than 24 hours. And we have people who have spent decades in those conditions.
Well, when you get to the 10,000-year number, we have crossed decades.
Yeah, no doubt.
That brings a perspective and a perception on that in a way that's incomprehensible.
Let me give you a number and see what you think about this. I think I read that since 1989, about 1,500 people have been exonerated through DNA. So there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. They were obviously innocent.
Right.
And I was given an interview with a reporter from New York, and he goes, "What do you think about that?" And I said, "Well, I said there's a bigger number than 1,500." He goes, "What's that?" I go, "Well, it's 12 times 1,500." He goes, "Well, what's that?" I go, "Well, that's how many jury members got it wrong." And
wow.
I said, There's another number, and that is 3 times 1,500." He goes, "Well, what is that?" I said, "That's how many appeal judges got it wrong. There's usually more, but at least 3. And I said, "And there's a bigger number than that one." He goes, "What is that?" I go, "Well, it's 1,500. He goes, "No, we talked about that." I go, "No, it's the wrong set of people. 1,500, that's how many prosecutors either knew or should have known that these people who were exonerated through DNA were innocent and let them go to prison anyway. There's the problem right there. And those numbers do not lie. Those numbers are irrefutable. And now, Ken Anderson, I don't know if you know who he is, from Georgetown, Texas. He actually was a judge. He lied in a case. He lost his law license as a judge, and he served, I think, 3 days in jail. The worm is turning. Things are changing. Mike Nifong is another one. He spent 24 hours in jail. Now, that never happened before. I think that the public is starting to see that there needs to be a change. This is just, as they say in Australia, the thin edge of the wedge. And conversations like this, radio programs like this, we're gaining momentum. We're making people aware. People are insensitive to the situation. I think we're going to start to sensitize them, and I think that we'll get legislation. I think we got to keep pushing it, just like with civil rights. We got to keep pushing it until there is accountability for these prosecutors. Sooner the better.
Absolutely.
Mr. Ferguson, we had a question come through our chat room. Our listeners are wanting to know how they are able to, in what way can they support you in your efforts to change the immunity for prosecutors?
Well, right now we're lining up legislators to talk to. So if they could just speak to their local legislator, and if we can start to find 1, 10, 20, a certain number of legislators that at least listen to us, if they could just contact a local member of their state legislature, whether they're representatives or senators at the state level, and let me know who those people are. We need to find some people that at least listen to what we're talking about with this immunity, and then we'll build up a core of a momentum, just like the civil rights movement did, like a lot of other things. That's how people can help out.
Thank you, Mr. Ferguson. HAC Radio, where we are bringing the message of justice around the world. Our special guest this evening is Mr. Bill Ferguson. He is the father of Ryan Ferguson, who is exonerated of a crime that he did not commit. And Mr. Ferguson is sharing some information with us as to, you know, the impact that a wrongful conviction has on families. I'm Sam Thurman along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Our phone number this evening is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and have Mr. Ferguson close out this segment for us on the other side of this break. So you have one more opportunity to shoot a question at him. We'll be right back after this.
The United States of America incarcerates more people than any other country in the world. In fact, the U.S. hosts more prison inmates than all other developed nations combined. As of 2010, the world population was over 6.8 billion people, with an estimated 9.8 million in jail. This figure, compiled by the International Center for Prison Studies, refers both to individuals held in jail awaiting trial and inmates serving time after sentencing. So there are 9.8 million human beings on planet Earth living inside of cages that we know of. In 2010, the U.S. was home to about 309 million people, 4.5% of the world's total population, but housed 23% of the world's prisoners. So take a moment to think about what this means. It means we imprison more people than enormous autocratic countries like China. We imprison more people than Russia. Compared to the size of our population, our rate of imprisonment dwarfs our closest allies, like the United Kingdom, France, and Canada. As of 2010, there were over 1.6 million post-trial inmates serving sentences in America's state and federal facilities. This number does not include those being detained pre-trial or those on probation. The most unique feature of incarceration in America is the large and active role of our federal government. In most countries, crime is reacted to at the local or regional level, whereas the American government finances and legislates a significant portion of law enforcement at the national level. State governments still do their fair share of incarceration, though. California and Texas incarcerate more than other states, with over 171,000 inmates each. Florida is a close third with over 103,000 prisoners. But no single state locks up more people than the federal government, with over 208,000 inmates. Perhaps the nickname Land of the Free, Home of the Brave, should be updated. Though I suppose you need to be brave to endure the highest likelihood of incarceration the world has ever known. Prisons are not what we think about when we think of America, and they shouldn't have to be. A free nation shouldn't imprison so many people, and a fiscally responsible nation can't afford to. With close to $40 billion a year in state correctional spending, the financial costs are obvious and staggering alone, but the human costs are often underappreciated. 1.6 million fathers and mothers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters of American families are incarcerated. It's time for people to realize that the criminal justice system in America is desperately in need of reform.
Ladies and gentlemen of America, we find ourselves in a precarious situation as America, its citizens, stand at the crossroads of decision. Well, AJC Radio is committed. Coming June 4th, 2015, every Thursday evening, we will introduce a new campaign entitled Spotlight on Capitol Hill. The purpose of this campaign is to take each and every Thursday, we will spotlight a member of Congress and the initiatives that are important not only to them, but to their constituents and the nation and this country as a whole. Our purpose is to shine the light on congressmen, senators, men and women who are committed to the oath that they took when they were elected to public office. We find it very important that we would shine the light on something that is positive in a time of critical challenges that face this nation. So I invite you tonight to join us beginning June 4th every Thursday as we introduce Spotlight on Capitol Hill. As all Americans are trying to do, we are seeking justice. Join us for an exciting time of highlighting your congressman and your senator, that we might come together as a people and as a nation to bring about change. We look forward to you joining us June 4th and every Thursday thereafter. God bless you and God bless America.
Lisa Stewart and Lamont Banks, Sam Thurmond. This evening we're talking about the impact of wrongful convictions on families. Our phone number this evening is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Please call, give us your question or comment. Also, you can join us in the chat room online. And we appreciate the folks who are in the chat room and providing some information. You know, as we look at some of the stats that are out there, some of the causes that contribute to wrongful convictions, you know, the number one reason is eyewitness misidentification. And you got somewhere between 75-80% of wrongful convictions and that were the result of eyewitness misidentification. As I stated, joining us is Mr. Bill Ferguson, the father of Ryan Ferguson, who was wrongfully convicted and incarcerated. He has now been exonerated. And again, Mr. Ferguson, thank you for joining us. So if folks want to get in contact with you and see how they can help you with some of the initiatives that you're working on, how can they go about doing that?
Well, let me give you my email address, if you'd like. It's MZURI, the numeral 4, the letter U, at AOL.com.
Okay, and we'll actually post that on our archive with along with this interview, and then that way folks can just click on it and be able to reach out to you as well. I did have one other quick question for you. You know, we talked about the various impact to families and how you talk about the physical, the psychological, and so forth. As far as the financial impact, now I know later on you had high-profile attorney Kathleen Zellner to join the team, and correct me if I'm wrong, but she joined on a pro bono basis and helped to work Ryan's case. But prior to that, it had to be a tremendous financial burden on your family.
Oh, yeah. We spent all the money that we have. But it cost us over $300,000 just to get through the appeal process. And then, thank goodness, Kathleen Zellner came along and worked the case pro bono. But we were fortunate. We had Dateline and 48 hours. And people say, well, how did you get Dateline and 48 hours to help you? That's because we knew the discovery. We knew the evidence. We knew the police reports. So whenever we got that first interview, we could take them on the crime scene. We could point out everything, and we documented everything. And so now we're not talking about emotion. We're not crying. We're not, boo-hooing. We're saying these are the facts. Here they are. Here's the police reports. Here's the evidence. The discovery. Here's all the information. And so they can say they had a good story. And that's what got it promoted. And that's how Kathleen Zellner saw it. And that's how we ended up getting Kathleen and ultimately her helping us pro bono and ultimately freeing Ryan. That's how it all came to that.
Well, and I think that there are countless stories around the world, and certainly in the United States, that will mirror your situation when it comes to the financial burden that it places on a family. Mr. Ferguson, we applaud you for the efforts that you and your family and the team that you have there as far as working on Ryan's case and the things that you're doing even now to bring about legislation to change some of the immunity situations as regards to holding prosecutors accountable. Lamont, I know that you want to extend an invitation to Mr. Ferguson.
Yeah, Mr. Ferguson, again, thank you for joining us tonight and taking some time out of your schedule to enlighten us as well as our listeners out there across the United States tonight about what you've been through. We appreciate it. No, that's not always easy to share that personal experience, but we appreciate it that you've taken the time tonight. We've had an opportunity here at Just Cause to actually develop a very good relationship with members on the Hill. We do take our issues to Capitol Hill. We would love more than anything to maybe work with you and work together in a joint effort as we both, all of us in this situation, are seeking justice and change. We extend that invitation that perhaps we can work together not only at the state level but the federal level, since we have been there quite often and had an opportunity to talk to some congressmen and senators up there in regards to change needing to happen. So that invitation is extended to you cordially from us to you. And again, we appreciate you taking the time. I mean, and we'll definitely reach out to you and get back in contact with you on pursuing that if you're open to that.
I would jump at the opportunity. I would love to work with all of you in that endeavor. I think that's one of the greatest things that we could possibly do. And you can count on Ryan and I participating and working with each of you very diligently. We believe very strongly in what you're talking about. And the statistics that I'm hearing on these breaks in my earphones are very meaningful. The public is just insensitive to what's going on. If it doesn't affect them directly, then it's like talking about something going on in another galaxy. We've got to make it personal for everybody in this country to pull this country together. And so everything we can do legislatively or alerting the public as to what's going on, we need to work on strategies and opportunities to do that. So I welcome the opportunity to work with you. And if there's anything that Ryan and I could do, we will certainly be there to do it. You're a tremendous group of people. And a credit to all of us.
Well, thank you, Mr. Ferguson. We appreciate that. Have a good evening tonight. And we thank you for taking the time tonight. And Sam, as we, you know, as you hear that, there's a old song that's called He Ain't Heavy.
Yeah.
May not have the proper English, but I can tell you what, Ryan's my brother.
Yep.
The folks that are behind the wall, they're my brothers.
Yes.
They're my sisters. So as we get into a discussion in regards to the willingness to work together, that's what this program is about, that coming together as a people,
right,
regardless of race, color, religion, whatever you want to call it. We're about bringing about justice, and I said it before, I'll say it again, we are in search for Lady Justice. And
there's strength in numbers.
You know, more, it's kind of like somebody's gone missing. You'll have the whole neighborhood out in the woods and with flashlights
right.
and everything else. I extend a call to America that to search for justice. And Lady Justice, get your flashlights out and open your books, and let's find where justice has gone missing. And that's going to take people coming together and looking for her collectively. And that may sound repetitive, but Lady Justice is known to be one with the blindfold, rendering justice wherever she goes. We haven't seen that in quite some time in this country, and it's time that we find that again. So we appreciate Mr. Ferguson on that note.
And I want to echo that as well, Mr. Ferguson, as far as our thanks to you for taking time out of your schedule. And we'd like to send our well wishes to Ryan. And as Lamont was saying, we look forward to having you guys join in on some of the initiatives that that we are working on at this time. So thank you very much. Have a good evening, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you so much. We look forward to it.
All right. You know, that when you talk about some of the things that that Mr. Ferguson was bringing up, you have to, like he was saying, It takes a team, you know. It takes a village. I think is one of the things that that you have to look at. That you cannot just do it alone. And one of the things he said also is that you have to do your homework.
Absolutely.
You know, and as you guys, I mean, as far as representing a Just Cause and the many, how many trips to Washington, D.C.?
25 for me. That's since last June.
Right.
Within the last year, 25 trips to Capitol Hill.
Yes.
And you guys have seen that legislators on Capitol Hill, they know when you know what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
And they know when you don't know what you're talking about. And for a Just Cause, we have established a reputation of good representation and knowing what we're talking about when it comes to legislation and the issues that are at hand. And so when you build that type of reputation, then you can attract other folks, and then it feeds directly into what's going to be starting in the first week of June as far as the spotlight on Capitol Hill. We can then look at legislation that senators and congressmen have drafted, and we can help to push that type of legislation, because sure. We personally within a Just Cause have firsthand accounts, and then as far as a lot of the guests that we've had on the program, good example, Mr. Ferguson and Ryan, you know, when people experience injustice firsthand, then they know what the consequences are. They know what the drawbacks are. You can see the pitfalls and the potholes in the road, so to speak. Those who have not been touched personally by it, then it gets to that point that Mr. Ferguson was talking about, that, you know, the nation needs to be made aware, because people are complacent. If it's not happening to them, they see something on the evening news is going to give it about 7 seconds, maybe 10 seconds, mm-hmm. and then they're moving on. They're not going to give you all the meat and potatoes of that story, but there are meat and potatoes involved that people need to, you know, they need to understand what's on the menu, so to speak. Because if you don't know what's on the menu, then the system is going to feed you anything.
No, absolutely.
And if you don't know what you're eating,
sure.
you know, you're in trouble.
Well, no. Again, and that, of course, that's the food situation in the prison system. But the bottom line is that I think when you have people that are willing to come out and say, "Look, whatever we can do," as Mr. Ferguson did, I talked to a young lady today. Said, "How can I be of service to a Just Cause and to AJC Radio?" These are people that are involved in the judicial system that are saying, what can we do? And I'll be honest with you, Lisa, as we sit and we've talked to quite a few folks who I believe the tone has, at least the questions to what can we do to help, I believe is a result to the Michael Brown. The people say, well, why do we keep referencing that? Well, we're referencing that because that is when this country began to shift.
That's right.
That's when the exposure of the corruptness that's going on in this country began to come to light to Americans everywhere. I'll say it again. When a Michael Brown gets shot, when Eric Garner gets choked to death and murdered by law enforcement, when Walter Scott gets an 8-shot warning shot in his back, ladies and gentlemen, this is what it comes down to be. This is what causes us to say, you know what? We do need to not only talk, we need to act. We need to say, you know, and I'm going to tell you, the microphone, as far as in radio, is one of the most powerful weapons you will ever have to communicate a message, and that's what AJC Radio is about. Bringing the message of justice and the search for it around the world, not just into my backyard with my dog and cat and the barbecue grill and the family having some steaks on the grill, not just us. We're talking about going to every backyard and every place, every county, every city, every state, and we'll cross some waters if necessary going around the world with this message of justice, because justice, injustice in England is just as bad as injustice in America.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? This is a humankind of campaign. This is to change the mindset of human beings. We are human beings, and we have to pull together. So I think that's very, very serious. I think, Cliff, as we went into the numbers, 10,000 years.
Yes.
How many, again, I said the question, you know, the lifespan is about 70, 75, maybe 80. You may get 102, you know, as you get ready to check out. How many generations?
Yeah, you're looking at, you know, 1,000 more, 1,200 generations.
of years of wrongful.
Wrongful. These are the people who were exonerated. It's a total a total eye-opener. I thought of the other number that Mr. Ferguson brought up, you know, when he talked to the reporter saying, you know, the 1,500 cases that had been exonerated on DNA, and how he went into telling him, no, you know, you got to look at the other 1,500.
Sure.
You got to look at, you know, the other 4,500 appellate judges that got it wrong. But when you look at the impact on families,
sure,
you say if you have a mother and a father and a wife and one child, that's another 6,000. That is another 6,000 people who are impacted. Don't add friends and uncles and aunts and cousins, people with more than one child. I mean, the number gets just exponential on who is affected when we as a nation exonerate people wrongfully. And for that long, 10,000 years of just wasted time,
well,
wasted lives. And for anybody to say that the system works properly, they are either there's psychologically something wrong,
so
they have some type of veil on their face, or they are just blatantly lying to themselves to say that the system is working.
Well, look, Sam, and I thought about this. So, you know, we at AJC Radio, we're a family here. That's what we are.
Yeah.
Let's go to personal family. I remember when my sister was wrongfully incarcerated by Judge Aguayo. Never had any type of issue with the law. And I remember I was incarcerated at the time that this took place for her. I remember in the midst of what I was carrying behind that wall and all that I had suffered behind that wall, I remember feeling an anguish that was so extreme in my cell that night. Every night I thought about my sister laying in a cell, who I know my sister to be who she is, laying in a cold cell with a cheap blanket and a piece of cement I was laying on that they called a mattress.
Right.
People just casually say the impact. Do you even have any idea, America, if your mom is dragged into jail or prison in a jumpsuit, put in somewhere where she has to be told when to use the bathroom, when not to, your brother, your little brother, your old little sister, the impact, until it comes home to you, you're never going to get it.
That's right.
What if that's my dad in there who I just hugged at the breakfast table? You know, I think, Cliff, you said the story earlier, the man was sitting down having dinner.
Having dinner.
And arrested, taken. Think of the trauma of that. And I think we need to stop and really take a look. We have become so callous as a country that we say things and we don't even understand the depth of what we've said.
Well, and you know, Lamont, to your point, and as you were talking, it kind of, and you make a very valid point that, you know, society casually talks about the impact of something.
Sure.
And when you look at the magnitude of what that is, I just decided I quickly just pull up, you know, well, what does impact mean? And it says the action of one object coming forcibly into contact with another. So if you look at it in that context, and then, you know, it goes on to talk about a collision or a crash. If you look at a wrongful conviction, a wrongful incarceration as something that is forced up on you, it is a forcible collision,
sure,
between you and the system. You didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
The system came upon you forcibly, and you were subjected to it. It's like being, you know, being hit by a car. You are going to get thrust into the air and knocked so many feet or so many yards away, it may kill you.
What do they say? What do they say as far as the impact is worse in a situation? You know what that situation is? The blind side.
Yeah,
that's it.
That hurts worse.
It does,
because you never
saw it coming. You didn't see it coming.
If I'm seeing, I mean, I'm stuck on the road and I'm seeing a car coming and I'm stuck and I can't move.
Right, at least you can.
I know I can try to brace myself. I'm a dead man either way.
But you can at least try to respond.
Try to respond.
And for the guys that are out there that play football,
you know,
playing football, I mean, I got blindsided a couple of times.
Sure.
Nothing worse.
I'm telling you.
So,
it's like a truck hitting you from the side, and it's going to take you a while to recover or to regroup. It's like, what just happened?
And that's what we deal with. When my mother makes the statement, I raise my children to believe that if you do it right, you don't have nothing to be concerned about.
Right.
You don't have to worry about going to jail. You don't have to work because the system works. We get the chill bumps doing a patriotic speech at the National Convention, the Democratic or the Republican National Convention. We say, oh, this is America. When something like this happens in your life, when you talk about the numbers we're talking about, 6 months, I don't care, again, like I said earlier, if it's one day locked behind a wall and your liberty is taken, you have been blindsided.
Yeah.
So think about that mother. My mother, three children.
Yes.
That's three blindside accidents. You are lucky to survive one.
That's right.
This is three.
That's right.
This is not only three. Now you have, well, three, and then you got the RP6, other five members of the RP6 folks.
That's right.
How many blinds? How am I supposed to survive that?
Right. And the thing that adds to that I think makes it extremely sickening after the fact that you get wrongfully convicted. You look at a judge like in Judge Christine Arguello's case, and especially with LaWanna Clark. You have the evidence on the table,
sure,
that says this person is innocent. And what is your response to that? I'm not going to deal with that evidence. You should have brought it earlier. What kind of sense does that make in any person's mind to say that I'm not going to deal with the evidence that says that you're innocent? How does that in anybody's logic come into play? But then to say that a judge does it, those are the sure type of things that when you look at the system, you say, how? How can it be this corrupt? How does a prosecutor, you look at a prosecutor and you say, okay, if he goes outside the bounds of what he's supposed to do, maybe he's looking for his conviction rate. Maybe he feels like that's going to make him a great prosecutor if he gets his conviction rate. But a judge,
yeah, sure,
to say, I'm not even going to deal with it because you should have brought it earlier. Then you wonder why people take the law into their own hand and say, okay, well, if I don't get justice from a judge, who else do I go to? I got to go to Smith & Wesson. I got to go to Glock. That is the outcome of what happens when the justice system fails.
Sure.
And, you know, I just as a disclaimer, I'm not advocating anybody go shoot anybody. I'm just saying these are sometimes the reason why people die for no particular reason, because justice was not afforded to them when it could have been very easy.
Well, look, we said it, Sam. We'll say it again. This is the reason why the country is falling apart. This is why we're crying for justice. This is why we're saying, Congress, senators, what can we do? What can you do? What can we do as a nation, as America? Continue to fight the fight for justice.
Absolutely.
That fight never stops.
Cliff asked the question, you know, what sense does that make, you know, for a judge to have that type of power? And the answer is, it doesn't make sense. But I would go a step further and say that what you're dealing with at that point is a person that does not have a conscience.
Sure.
I mean, you've got issues of accountability. They don't care about accountability. You got issues of consciousness. They don't care about consciousness. They don't care about anything. They're on a power trip. This is AJC Radio, bringing the message of justice around the world. I'm Sam Thurman, Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. We'll be right back in a moment to close things out. Don't go anywhere.
Did you ever have something you ever wanted to do as a child? Be an astronaut, be a doctor. I always wanted to be a police officer. And there's a strong sense of pride in being a police officer. You know, not just out there just to stop people for the heck of it. It's just not logic, not law. We no more want to accuse someone or charge somebody with a crime that they didn't do, any more than they want to be charged with it. So we take that responsibility, especially with sexual assaults, very seriously.
I think my greatest fear, one of the greatest fears that many investigators experience is convicting the wrong person.
As police officers, one of the things that we're always very concerned about is the potential that we have for putting an innocent person into jail if we do not do our job properly. The end product for us is to know that we did our job properly and that justice is being done properly.
Thank you.
for equality.
I stand for individuality.
I stand for peace.
I stand for diversity.
I stand for dignity.
I stand for respect.
I stand for fairness.
Red, yellow, black,
white.
We're all the same color.
When you turn out the lights.
Each week, A Just Cause Coast to Coast shares compelling stories about judicial injustice. But AJC doesn't leave it there. AJC Radio presents top guests from across the country who are advocates, activists, attorneys, and judges who provide insight into current events and the law. Now, if you believe in what AJC is doing, we ask that you make a donation of any amount. Your kindness will be greatly appreciated. Go to www.a-justcause.com and click on the donate button. Again, www.a-justcause.com and click on the donate button.
AJC Radio, bringing the message of justice around the world. Mike Banks, Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, I'm Sam Thurman. We've had some excellent discussion this evening. You know, I was just looking at, I was thinking about the fact that, like Mr. Ferguson and Ryan and the team there, a just cause, if you will, you know, it takes courage. And, you know, I look at even, you know, if a judge is sitting on the bench, it takes courage for that judge to even make waves and say, I'm going to go against the grain. I mean, I look at retired federal judge H. Lee Sarikin, you know, with him in the situation with Reuben Hurricane Carter and how Judge Sarikin even got involved in the IRP 6 case. And being one that goes against the grain and taking the courage to say, this is wrong. It needs to be changed. And, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. has a quote out there that says, courage is an inner resolution to go forward despite obstacles. You know, yes, obstacles are out there. But if that obstacle is something that has the label injustice, then we as a nation, we as a people, we as advocacy groups, you know, need to align together. Yeah. To blindside some of those, well, you know, blindside some of those obstacles.
Well, I'll tell you this, Sam, and Lisa, you're a mother. Cliff, you're a father. Sam, you're a father. I'll tell you this right now. You know, you folks, maybe as the evening has gone on, and right now it's about 10 o'clock in New York City and on the east coast of this country right now. You know, little Bob and the little children are probably tucked in already. They've had some nice roast beef or maybe a piece of chicken and some cornbread to go to bed with on a full stomach. And if you've had that, you've been fortunate to have that. But I'll tell you this, Sam, as you make the point, this is about them.
Yes.
You know, little Johnny or little Lisa or Lisa, your little Cole may have to go before a judge one day. This is about them.
Yeah,
you know, you may be long gone, but guess what? What we fight for today is about our children and their children. And I'm sure, you know, when you moms out there in America that have tuned into the show, as you tucked the kids in the night and got them warm and made them feel safe in your home, you've locked the doors and bolted the windows and all that good stuff, because guess what? You're in America. You want to be safe. You want your children safe. Well, I got news for you. If you want that, it's going to take you coming together. It's going to take you as a mother. We need mothers to cry out against this injustice. We need fathers to cry out. And, you know, I'm a son, and, you know, I've seen, you know, my mother hurt over this injustice that has happened. You cannot not love someone or care about someone and not feel a need or a compelling to get into this fight. Lisa, you had some thoughts on that?
No, I think any, whether it's a mother, father, whoever it may be, an aunt or an uncle, it doesn't really matter. If it's someone that you love, that's what brings it home to you. If it's someone that I care about, it's going to bring it home to you in a much bigger way than just hearing the stories on the news. I mean, hearing the stories that I've seen, I mean, they bring tears to your eyes when you see what's happening. But when it comes home, just like you were talking about our sister, Luana, who was locked up, when it comes home to you, it's a whole different kind of feeling. It changes your outlook. It changes you as a person. It changes everything, because all of a sudden this becomes more real than anything else you've ever dealt with, and you have to deal with that. And as much as you'd like to try to get away from it, you have to deal with that.
No, absolutely. And Sam, as Mr. Ferguson was talking, I can't imagine the countless or the sleepless nights in 9 years and 8 months.
Yeah.
How many times he anguished, showed that anguish over his son, knowing his son was innocent.
Yeah.
Which compiles the burden that you carry. It's uncomprehendable to me. And I think until you make it personal, you know, you say sometimes, well, this isn't personal. Well, it absolutely is personal all the way.
Well, and you know, Lamont, you said that this is about the younger people that are coming on and coming along. And, you know, I was on assignment last week, and you guys had Dean Shelley Broderick on, and it was an excellent, excellent show. And listening to how she, you know, got her law school students involved in the situation in Baltimore and so forth. And if I recall correctly, she actually made a comment to the effect that she feels that she is bringing on the next generation of legal advocates. And for those law students who have a passion for righting the wrongs that exist in our judicial system, for those who are looking at the higher calling, if you will, that it's more than about, you know, a $250 an hour or $500 or $700 an hour retainer fee, that it is about, it really is about justice. When I heard Dean Broderick say that, you know, I thought, yeah, that's what it's really supposed to be about. Bringing and culturing or cultivating that next generation of advocates, because that is what it's going to take. And like you said, Lamont, it is about them. And if they don't get involved in helping to establish their own fate, then they're going to be subjected to whatever fate is thrust upon them, or forcibly thrust upon them, as we talked about the definition of impact.
Absolutely.
So, hey, Lamont, why don't we go on and give us a quick reminder about what we're getting ready to do as far as some of the changes to the program starting in that first week of June.
Okay, folks, ladies and gentlemen out there, beginning June 4th, Thursday, and every Thursday after that, we will be starting a campaign called Spotlight on Capitol Hill. That's going to give us an opportunity to hear from congressmen, senators, and the legislators that you took the time, maybe in the cold and the rain and the snow on a cold November day, that they've been in office, that they might provide public service. We're going to actually have an opportunity to share their passion, their legislation, what brought them to Washington, D.C. in hopes of maintaining and bringing about change. This is a personal invitation, inviting you, your family. And I'll tell you this right now, Sam, and I'll say it to everybody, Lisa and Cliff and everybody that's listening to this program all across this country. When you went to the polls on that November day, you went with the hope that change would come. We are approaching another election in a year or so from now, a little longer than that. But people are going to the polls for one reason, and that's because they believe that something can change. Spotlight on Capitol Hill will speak to those issues. We will have folks that we believe we will be pushing the legislation and the hopeful legislation of our future leaders, presidential candidates, what their positions are as they begin to take the journey for the White House on Pennsylvania Avenue. And this is an invitation. So stay tuned to this radio network, and we will continue to keep you informed. But this, the kickoff of that will be June 4th, and we're looking very forward to that. Sam.
Excellent. Lisa, I know we have an appeal that we want to put out to folks in support of the IRP6.
Yes, we're asking everyone and to go out to GoFundMe.com. If you go out to that website, you do a search on IRP6, and you'll find a place where you're able to donate directly to families of the IRP6. These are the wives, the children, the people that are left in the wake of this horrible, horrible tragedy of wrongful conviction. And they're trying to deal with that in their own way. They need your support. They need whatever support you're able to offer. So anyone who has the ability, who has a computer or a smartphone, go out to GoFundMe.com and donate whatever you can to support the family.
Thank you, Lisa. And we'd also like to remind you to keep the IRP 6 in your prayers. That's prayers. That is David Banks, Dave Cipolla, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. And for more information about the IRP 6, we ask that you go out to freetheirp6.org. Again, freetheirp6.org. You can get more in-depth information about the IRP 6 case. And I want to remind you that a Just Cause is a 501c3, and we can certainly welcome any donations. So go out to our website, www.a-justcause.com, and click on the donate button. For archives of our program, go to AJC Radio. For weekly archives, you can also go to live365.com for 24/7 programming. And then every Sunday morning, tune in to Progressive Radio Network at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time. You can get there by going to prn.fm. And then for on-demand programming for downloading, you can go to the405radio.com or to iTunes. And again, as we stated before, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Cliff.
All right, I want to say thank you to everyone in the chat room for all of your questions and your comments. Thank you to our guest, Bill, and we appreciate you taking time out of your evening to spend with us tonight. Great conversation. Also, I want to say thank you to our production team, K&D Productions, Captain Kyle and Dustin Jackson, helping out Ill Skillers Girl to make sure that you hear what it is that we have to say. Also, want to say thank you to the production support team. They give us accurate and up-to-date information so that we can pass that on to you. Also, to the troop, know you're out there. We appreciate it.
Join us each week on Tuesday and Thursday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time right here on Blog Talk Radio, AJC Radio Network, where we are bringing the message of justice around the world. Lamont.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen out there tonight, as you get tucked into bed and you turn the lights off and turn the porch light on, don't forget when you wake up tomorrow morning, the freedom which you raise your head up on and you set your foot on that front porch came with a price. As Memorial Day approaches, we want to say thank you to the soldiers that laid down their lives along the way. And for that purpose, AJC Radio continues to seek justice on a day-to-day basis. Good night.
Hi. Good night, America.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over that. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. So that is, I say, we aren't gonna let any dog or water hose that's turn us around. We aren't gonna let
the road.